I got a blue one.
Okay.
That's extra. Doesn't have Radaka Rashi, but more or less. And there's those with Mepharshim in these.
You
want to
switch?
No.
What's the one?
I've got a Mikro Kedolot. I've got a Mikro.
Where are we?
We are on chapter 10. We're almost up to Yitzchak, and we'll wind up going to Yitzchak today.
Busy.
You know what, let me just toss these down and everybody can take one. Okay, I'm going to start on time, which I promised to do, and talk about Yiftach. So we're on chapter 10, and something very strange happens in chapter 10 right before we get to Yiftach, and the question is why it happens. I'll tell you what Menachem Liebtag says about it, and then I'll give you another interpretation, which I think is not exactly in contradiction with his, but it sheds some light on things that he does not shed light on. We start off in chapter 10. Of course, Avi, the last character we had, is Avimelech, a total failure, to say the least, wind up being killed by his own people, by his own supporters, after murdering his own brothers, a real failure, the son of Gidon. And before we get to the story of Yiftach, which is chapter 11, we have a rather short chapter, chapter 10, half of chapter 10 from Pasuk Vav on is really another, from Pasuk Vav, from verse 6 to verse 16, is pretty much a cycle that we've seen before. God repeats the cycle that because you didn't listen to me, so I sent people to conquer you, and only when you started praying to me, then I appointed leaders. We've seen this speech before. Hi, how are you? Pasuk Yud Zayin and Yud Chet, the last two psukim of verse of chapter 10, and we're in the book of Shoftim.
Shoftim?
Yes. Do you want to...
Okay.
And there's an English one, too.
Okay, good. I like this one.
Okay. The last two psukim are essentially a setup for Yiftach. They tell us the bad guys that come before the salvation by the hands of the prophet. It's the first few psukim from verse 1 to verse 5, which I personally find very profound, even though they look as not profound. So let's read them.
Are we talking about 11 now?
Chapter 10. Essentially, the whole second half of 10 is really just given Musar. Last two psukim deal with Yiftach, but the first five psukim seem to be dealing with something which is very minor, when in fact it's very major. Let me read chapter 10, verse 1. Vayakam acharei Avimelech, and after Avimelech there arose Hoshiat Israel, to save Israel, Tola ben Pua ben Dodo Ish Yisachar. So essentially the tribe of Yisachar now gets a chance to spot their own leader. His name is Tola ben Pua ben Dodo. V'hu yoshev b'Shamir b'Har Ephraim. He lives in a place called Shamir in Har Ephraim. Har Ephraim, by the way, is not only in the tribe of Ephraim. Har Ephraim goes all the way up to Menasheh, and we'll even go quite as far as lower Yisachar, on the border of Yisachar, so you'll have them touching a little bit on the territory of Har Ephraim. Vayishpoti Yisrael Esrim V'Shalosh Shana, and he rules over Israel 23 years. Vayamat Vayikaver B'Shamir, and he dies, and they bury him in Shamir in his city. And that's all we know about him. That's it. Every other prophet, there were the Shofet up to this point. We've got stories, got something. Here we have nothing. And what's interesting is we got 23 years to play with. If he only ruled, let's say, Shamgar ben Anat, okay, Shamgar ben Anat only got a few psukim. At least we found out that he took the yoke of a cow and started slaughtering people around. And it makes sense he only gets a few psukim because he only ruled for a year, I think. It was a year or 2 years, tops. But here we have a guy who rules for 23 years, a reasonably successful period of time, and we know nothing about him. Zero, nothing. Now
is there a difference, though, between him and all the other shofim that came before him? Like, he just, by a kamachari Avimelech, like, Moshe Yisrael, who's saving them from?
It's true, and there is commentaries that say he was saving them from Avimelech. That's the play on the word. Nonetheless, he was Moshiach, like the other judges. Oh, there's no question that there's a qualitative difference. Otherwise, you wouldn't get to psukim. I want to know why. I want to know what's missing here. And what I can tell you is there's something going on here that doesn't meet the eye, that meets the eye, but it's not clear to see. There's a lot in these two psukim, but it will soon.
When they say Ben Dodo, is Dodo a name, or is that...
Rashi says it's a name. It could be the son of his uncle, and I prefer the second parish for a reason which I'll explain to you shortly.
Okay.
The son of his uncle.
The son of his uncle, which means they kept him in the family. This is significant, and I will explain to you why. Well, Rashi just says Dodo was the name of the person. Vayakam acharav, and now let's go to the next guy who gets one more pasuk, so he's a big player. He actually gets three pasukim. Vayakam acharav Yair HaGiladi. Yair HaGiladi. Now the Gilad is Shevet Menashe on the other side of the Jordan River. You have maps here if you like.
Yeah.
So Gilad would be up by line 20. If you go to line 20 and take a left, you'll see that whole area where it says Manasseh on the right-hand side of the Jordan River, on the east side of the Jordan River, that would be the Gilad. And I'll get much more into maps later because it's going to be very important for our understanding of what's going on. You okay?
I'm in trouble already.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Don't worry, most of it's text. Vayishpot Yisrael esrim u'shtayim shana. Not bad. He makes it for 22 years. Not too much shorter than the other one. Now here we get a little bit of a story. Vayihilo shloshim banim. He has 30 sons. Rochvim al shloshim ayarim. Who are riding on 30 donkeys. Ayarim are donkeys. U'shloshim ayarim lahem. And they have 30 donkeys. Now this does not mean that the donkeys have donkeys. It's a play on words. The first ayarim is short of yud, and it means donkeys. The second ayarim means cities. How do we know it means cities? Because it'll explain in a second. And they have 30 cities, which means each one of the sons, obviously, not only had a personal donkey, but he also had a personal city. What were they called? Lahem yikru chavot ya'ir. They were called chavot ya'ir, the cities of ya'ir, which was the name of course, the leader here, right? The name of the shofet is ya'ir. Ad hayom hazeh, until this very day, asher be'eretz ha-gilad, which are in the land of the Gilad, which again is on the east bank of the Jordan River to the north, a little bit under the Golan Heights. Vayama Yair vayikaber bekamon, and he dies and he gets buried in Kamon. Now you can get a little taste that there's something going on. Is anybody bothered by something? First of all, just graphically, from the words themselves, you could feel that the Navi is trying to give us a message by having a wordplay. What's the wordplay here? The Ayarim and the Ayarim. They're there. It's there for a wordplay reason. He wants us to pay attention. He could have said Chamorim. He could have said Chamorim. But he doesn't. He chooses the word Ayarim specifically to tie them together to the cities. So your question has to be, well, what's the connection between the cities and the donkeys?
Well, if it's exactly the same word, why isn't the cities first and then donkeys? Isn't it more important that they have 30 cities than they rode on?
Yeah, although if it was the other way, you could ask me a question the other way also.
Yeah, but it says rochvim al shloshim. It says riding.
Right. Yeah, you could have said lahem shloshim ayarim v'rochvim al shloshim ayarim.
Is there a reason that there must be something important about the riding on donkeys?
Yes, I'll get to it.
Crucial. City.
The riding on the donkeys is crucial. I'm not sure you could argue that it's necessarily more crucial than you might think that it's just like a meet. That'd be like saying, "Hi, my name is Rabbi Levy, and by the way, I ride a Honda." Like, who cares, really, honestly? But if I said I'm Rabbi Levy and I drive a 1967 Porsche, that you'd pay attention to. So what I'll show to you is that running on donkeys was those days' version of Porsches. Only the kings had them, and I'm already giving away part of my shear. And I'll... What's that? Susim Bachurim, the chosen horses. Okay. Super horses. So we'll see what they are. I believe I saw a translation of Ayarim. I didn't see the Rashi. I thought it was Davka donkeys. Now, in analyzing these, we're left with almost incredibly no information. We have a humongous story about Elimelech, and before that we got a gigantic story about his father, Gidon. And afterwards, we're going to spend two chapters on Yiftach, even though he was a bad guy. So even if you want to say, oh, maybe these guys were bad guys, they don't deserve to be talked about. Hafuch! The whole point of Shevet Shoftim is to talk about the good and the bad. We talked about the good as far as Gidon, the bad as far as Yiftach, and after Meshimshon, we spend another three chapters on. So why do these guys get nothing, so it seems? That is, where's the story? So there are two possible approaches, three possible approaches. I want to reject the first two, but I want to raise them. One is it's historical. This is a historical text. It's a book of the Jewish history during this time. There were these guys. I got nothing special to say, or perhaps there was you could say either Shmuel received no nebuah about them, or there was no historical documents written about these guys. He had nothing to write about, but you couldn't leave them out because they are historical. So he put in the very little information just to make sure that it was a book of kings. Very difficult opinion, because we've already noticed in the book of Shoftim that it's not historical, but it's written sometimes out of chronological sequence. The chronology is less important, in fact, than the setup. The move up to Gidon, then down, and the final two stories. Oh, I'm sorry. There's also space over here.
All right.
But there's something else which I should note of importance. I'm not sure which to do first. Oh, the other one is to say that, okay, there was a message to tell about them, which is that, no, I mean, you can't say that, that there was essentially, they didn't do anything that the other prophet, that the other Shoftim hadn't done, and therefore there's no reason to mention them. I just want to mention them historically.
Was that the whole point of Shoftim is that there's a cycle that when Israel do bad, they send the Shoftim leads them, and then we go through the whole
But where's of the salvation? That is, I agree with you,
right,
but...
If you're alluding to the fact that they rode on donkeys, made them strong and powerful, maybe they were righteous as well, so there was no cycle because they were so powerful in their leadership, there was no...
It could be, but now I have got... You could say that it's an interesting opposite approach, that they were so powerful and so successful that there was no reason to talk about the details of their life. But I want to point out something else. Look at the end of Yiftach, to chapter 12, please. The end of chapter 12, after Yiftach is finished, we're in 12:8. Vayishpot acharav, in 12:8, at Yisrael, if this is after Yiftach dies, if tzan mi beit lechem, of course, whether he was Boaz or not is not the issue right now, vayhi lo, look what he has, shloshim banim u'shloshim banot, shilach achutza u'shloshim banot hevi levanav min achutz, he had 30 sons and daughters he sent out, he brought in other ones from outside. Two things are to note. One is, once again, we have a focus on the quantity of the kids. A lot of kids. But what's also interesting, how long does he rule for? No, look.
7 years.
7 years. Well, generally speaking, when a king only lives 7 years, it's because something happens to him. That's the rule. Unless you want to say he took over a very late life or he had the chas v'shalom heart condition, that's not why kings disappear after 7 years. Kings disappear after 7 years, and if you want proof of this, go through all the Sefer Melachim. The kings that only make it less than 10 years or so are the ones who are killed, either in battle or by other people who want to take over. Ah, you're going to say it's a one-time deal only, but take a look at the next one. Vayishpot acharav Yisrael et Eilon Azvuani. Vayishpot Yisrael Eser Shanim. He only makes it 10 years. Vayamat Eilon Azvuani. Vaykaber be'Eilon Beret Zvulon. In fact, it's quite chiastic. What do we have? We have the first shofet we hear nothing about, but he rules a long time. We have the second shofet that we've got lots and lots of kids, cities, kids. Then we have a long story about Yiftach. Then I have another shofet that makes it a short time, lots and lots of kids. And then I have another shofet at the end, which I have no information about whatsoever. So it takes a chiastic structure, with Yiftach being the centrality of that chiasm. So what it really means, to my mind, is that in order to understand Yiftach, you need to understand what's going on. So let's take a look at the first surprise. What's that? Oh, you're right. There's also, I apologize, there's also Avdon ben Hillel. You're right. I'm sorry. And he's incredibly important, and I skipped him. That's in chapter in 17. There's Avdon ben Hillel, and it also goes through the kids. Which pasuk is this? I lost my place. You're right. Afterwards, Avdon ben Hillel peretoni vahilo arba'im banim shoshim bnei banim rochvim al shivim ayarim. Here once again, I have the donkeys or the horses. Vayishpo Yisrael shmonishim. He makes it a lousy 8 years before something tragic happens to him. You can't tell me that they all had bad hearts. Okay, it doesn't happen. Something is going on with the lack of stability as far as the kingship. But what's interesting is, in Sefer Melachim, where we have gory detail about what happens to the kings that don't make it, here there's no word, or is there? So let's go back to the first one. Let me show you something very interesting. If we go back to chapter 10, let's see what the name of the guy is. His name is Tola ben Puah. Weird name, right? Tola ben Puah. Anybody else know a Tola or a Puah in the Torah? Take a look at the fourth source on the top of the... That's true, but here we have a slightly different one. Take a look in Bereshit Mem Vav. It's in line number one of the Tola ben Puah page. Let me read to you the children of Yisachar. Uvnei Yisachar, the children of Yisachar, Tola, Puva, Yov, and Shimron. Now you're saying, okay, that's close, but not exact. Puva, okay, I'm okay with that. So what about the Yov and the Shimron? Well, wait a second, it changes a little bit, because the names always modify a little bit. Let's take a look at when they're counted in Bamidbar. V'nei Yisachar l'mishpacham, Tola mishpachat ha-Tola'i, l'puva mishpachat ha-Puni, so you can see the nun is added sort of when you make it kind of plural or possessive, l'yashuv mishpachat ha-Yashuvi. Look at what happened to Yov's name. Yov's name got changed to Yashuv. L'shimron mishpachat ha-shimroni. And now I want you to see the final source in the Torah. This is what Ezra is writing. And looks what he does with the names of the sons. Ulevnei Yisachar, Tola, Ufua, Yashuv, v'shimron. Now, if you look at those four names, and now look back in our text, which I did not print for you, look at the look how the pasuk reads: Vayakam achrei avimelech loshiyat Yisrael tola ben pua v'hu yoshev b'shamir. Anybody know something interesting? It's a match. Even the word yoshev, v'hu yoshev, and he's living. The word yoshev matches the third son's name of Yisachar, which means the whole first pasuk is epigraphic. It essentially brings to mind the entirety of Shevet Yisachar. It's interesting, right? Which means the name. You're going to tell me, what does that mean, Rabbi Levi? Did they make up the name? No, Chas V'Shalom. That's one choice. Sometimes we give people names in the Torah, but what usually happens when somebody takes a rulership is sometimes he does what with his name? He changes it to be something significant. So here we have Shevet Yisachar for the first time. This is the first Shofet that they're putting forward. And what does he do? He changes his name to Tola Ben Pua. Now, it could be that these are standard names. It could be. Because normally within tribes, like in the tribe of Binyamin, you have a lot of Shimmies. In the tribe of Yehuda, we have a lot of Chors. Actually, if you look through Divrei Yamin, you'll find a decent amount of Chors. So you have names be repeated. But this is a little much, right? Tola Ben Pua, Yashuv Ben Shimron, Tola Ben Pua, Vehu Yoshev Ben Shimron. Right? Very interesting. The name of the city that is the capital city of Yisachar is named after none other than the fourth son of Yisachar. To my mind, what's happening here is Tola Ben Pua, or the Shevet itself, is setting up a leader, and they're making a statement. Who is this leader? Not some guy. This is the original child of Yisachar. Do you see he's making a powerful statement? And I want to show you how powerful that statement is with the next leader. Everybody, did everybody see the direction I want to go? I'll tip my hand so that you can see where I'm going. Gidon, if you remember, was a king. Even though he said he didn't want to be the king, if you remember, his 70 sons took over as kings. And in fact, Avimelech, who changes his own name, calls himself, in order to establish his power base, he calls himself Avimelech. My father was the king. What we're going to see is for the next four or five times, the Jews have the taste of kingship in their mouth, and they continue to try to go out of their way to establish on their own a king, and it fails each and every time in worse and worse, worse and worse ways. Let me take you to the next guy, Yair Agiladi. Anybody recognize that name, Yair? Yair is the original son of Menashe. Right? The original son of Menashe. Just like Pua was the original son of Yisachar, who was the original son of Menashe? There were two sons. It was Machir, it was Yair. Those are the two sons of Menashe. So this guy, coincidentally, and I don't think it's coincidentally, takes upon himself the Yair. But look what he builds. Something very interesting. Anybody have a problem with that? Look back in our verse, and what does it say? Let's forget about the horses or the donkeys right now. They had 30 cities. Lahem yikru chavot Yair. What's the problem with them having cities that are called chavot Yair? Anybody? What's the problem with them setting up cities that are called chavot Yair?
They're already set up.
They're already set up. Who set them up? The original Yair. Let's go back to the Torah and take a look. It's in source number, it's on line number 14. Yair ben Menashe, this is in, actually you'll find it, let's go to the one on line 44, which is in Devarim Perakim, although you can see it in both places. After they conquered the land of the Gilad, which by the way, on the map would be, the Gilad would be north of the Yarmouk River, a little further north than that. Gilad are really the hill lands. So if you take a look at that map up there, if you see right next to line 24, there's a river that runs east directly out of the Jordan River, halfway in between the Kinneret and the Dead Sea. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm. Is the
Gilad
west or east?
The Gilad is to the east.
Okay.
It's to the east. So if you take a look, that's called the Yarmouk River. To the south of the Yarmouk River, you have Gad and Reuven. To the north of the Yarmouk River, this map is not totally correct. You have Shevet Menashe. That's not really true, because the truth is, north of the Yarmouk River, you still have a little bit of flatlands. Not until it gets to the higher elevations do you start to call it the Gilad. So essentially, it's south of the Golan Heights and north of these flatlands. But the map is fairly accurate. Chavot Yair belonged to Og and Sichon. Right after they were destroyed, a guy named Yair went, and he went and captured the cities, which is in which is listed in Bamidbar. But let's read Devarim. Yair ben Menashe lakakit kol chevel argov, agvul agshuri v'machati, vayikra atam al shmo et habashan, chavot Yair, ale yom hazeh, kolum chavot Yair. Ulmachir natati et agilad. So I think that the Chavot Yair were actually to the north of the Gilad, already up in the Golan Heights, or at least the foothills of Golan Heights. Essentially, these cities were established. Oh, you can ask me a question. Wait a second. How is it possible that Menashe's son was still alive? So the Midrashim, of course, if you take the Midrashic approach, it's that he never died. It's a very interesting Medrash. It says, and again, this is Medrash, so there's another way to translate it without going into Medrash, but the Medrash is interesting, and it's pretty. When the Gzeira was on the Jewish people that everybody above 20 would die, it was everybody above 20, but everybody below 60. But because Yair and Machir were still alive, and they were about 200 years old, they were free to go, and they actually went into Eretz Israel, Machir and Yair. Oh, very good. So what you notice is something. Where do you see that? Very good. So Chemi has already solved the problem. You really don't need to create out of Yair and Machir incredibly old, long living people. Not that it's impossible to do such a thing, but you don't have to make credit of long living people, because it says Vayechu b'nei Machir b'menashe gilad v'yil kedua, which means the children, or more specifically, the descendants of Machir. Very often in the Torah, when it speaks about the children of, it will also say Yisrael. Yoru Toratecha li Yisrael, Mishpatecha li Yaakov, Toratecha li Yisrael. Right? Vayehi bishurun melech. Very often you don't use the word b'nei, because you know that the original father is not alive. What you're trying to say is that it's the dynasty. It's symbolic of a dynasty, but more not just from a family tree standpoint, but even from a political standpoint. We're showing you that the dynasty of Machir is exactly right. It's not just a lineage thing. It's a political, a power, a tribal thing, which is very important. Yeah.
Then why does it say Yair ben Menashe before it says B'nai? Why would they juxtapose?
Okay, it's a good question. I tend not to believe that the Medrash is really trying to say that Yair and Machir. You could go either way. That's a good question. I don't know how to resolve that. But what you notice about the Feyre Peder says at least B'nai Machir. So maybe you want to say Machir died early, but Yair lived a long time. You could go either way. You don't have to put... What's that? You could actually do something else, which is into the Midrashim, which is that Yair went up to the Golan Heights to conquer those cities while the Jews were still in exile. Because keep in mind, you know, we tend to look at things as black and white. So when the Jews were slaves in Egypt, they were slaves in Egypt. Nobody left their doors without passing their, you know, swipe card through their thing. Obviously, they lived in Goshen. Goshen's on the very outskirt edges of Egypt. Israel at the time is controlled by Egypt, so they have nowhere to run to because it's all Egyptian territory anyway. But it's impossible to assume that over 210 years that no Jews managed to say, you know what, I want to go live in Israel. I want to go conquer. It's impossible. Well, it's true that the Jews were slaves in Egypt. To say that no Jews ever, especially from the tribe of Yosef, that had a certain amount, at least for a while, a certain amount of political pull, that they never had rights to travel where they wanted to ever is impossible. I could actually show you in Divrei Yamin, which does mention explicitly that some Jews went out of Egypt, and there's a famous medrash that you may have heard of. When the Jews are going out of Egypt for the first time, they didn't have to go through the Red Sea. They were actually going up Derech Eretz Plishtim, right? And why did they turn back? Does anybody know the medrash? They saw the bones of the children of Yosef, who had been tried to go that way previously, and they were killed by the Plishtim. It wasn't that they'd be afraid of the Plishtim, they'd be afraid of the dead bones of the tribes of Yosef. What is that Medrash essentially telling you? And it's just telling you that Yosef, as a tribe, or as a portion of a tribe, had tried to go back to Israel during the Egyptian exile, and it failed miserably, which is correct, which means the Medrash shouldn't be understood as pshat, but it's absolutely right that Jews did try to go back to Israel and probably failed miserably during the 210 years. But let's get back to the issue of Yair Giladi. We now have it set up that there's a message going on here, because we're not just talking about any rulers. It's focused on, the pasuk has been arranged. Now, if you want to say that he took upon himself Tola ben Pua, that would be fine. But the pasuk, using the word Yashuv and Shomron, which he did not take upon himself, seem to specifically be indicating that they're trying to make a symbolic representation. Here, Shevet Yisachar. And now, by the way, Shevet Yair, you know which cities they took? They took the same cities that Yair set up when he first set up his tribal lands. The donkeys, by the way, we know from I don't want to go into it textually, but we know this from David. David's children all rode pedarim, they all rode donkeys. essentially generals rode donkeys, so there it's an issue of either kingship or rulership. But there's something else significant about the children and the fact that they all get cities. For this, we'll have to jump ahead to the children at the end in chapter 12. And here we get, see, every time we get a kid, we get kind of like this, sometimes a little more information, every time we talk about the kids. So let's go to the next kids, which are in chapter 12, verse 8. And it says, "Vayishfot achrav Yisrael titzami beit lechem, vayihilo shloshim banim ushloshim banot." So now we not only know about sons, we know about daughters. Now how many times do you actually find out about daughters in the Torah? How many times are daughters ever mentioned? Rarely. Usually it's trying to tell you that this daughter is specifically very important. For instance, Mezahav. And there are other ones. Timna was also won by Shevet Shimon, I think various ones. These women are usually powerful and significant women that we hear about when they're mentioned by the Torah. Shalachot, now here's an interesting thing. Ushloshim banot shalachot achutza, ushloshim banot hevi lebanav min achutz. He sent 30 of his daughters out, and he took 30 daughters out in. What does that mean? Out of the house? What do you think that means when you send your daughter out to be married? What does that indicate? Do you have a sense of what it might mean? Exactly, alliances and treaties. So the question is, out of where? Out of Israel? Were they making alliances? So you might say they're making alliances outside of Eretz Israel. But I want you to hold that thought. But here, that's the correct way to interpret this. There are 30 daughters going out to create marriage alliances, and there are 30 other people somewhere who are willing to marry off their daughter to this guy. These are not the trappings of such just a shofet, by the way. This is the trappings of a king, of a person trying to establish extraterritorial power. But here's the real cincher. Let's go to Avdon ben Hillel. He is the one in Pasuk Yud Gimel. That's chapter 12, verse 13. Vayihilo arba'im banim, he had 40 kids, ushloshim b'nei banim, and 30 grandchildren, rochvim al shivim ayirim vayishbo Yisrael shmoneh shanim. First of all, how did he have all those kids in 8 years? Was he successful or was he not successful? But how many boys are there all together? 70. Who does that remind you of? Let it take you back. Who does that remind you of? In our book, Gidon. Gidon's 70 kids. But what happens to Gidon's 70 kids? They get killed. No, they don't kill each other. Abimelech kills them all in order to take the kingship. And here we have a repeat of the 70 kids specifically set up on donkeys. I have a question for you. Do we hear anything about donkeys during Gidon's time? Nothing. Because Gidon didn't really want to take the Melucha. Even though de facto it was established that way, he didn't want to take the Melucha. I have a question. Where did they all live? Gidon's children, where did they all live? We know exactly where they lived. Where did they live? They lived in a city. They were with him in a city. But not by Yair. What did Yair do for his 30 Israel kids? He established each one with Chavot Yair. These are famous cities. Each one, according to in Shlomo, in Sefer in the beginning of Sefer Malachim, each one Rav Bariach. It's got a. These are fortified cities of significance, which means each child is set up to rule over a city, a control, a district.
But then, if you're trying to set up a kingship,
go ahead. Because generally speaking, you want your kids to take over. People always send their kids out. It's very common for kings to set up their kids. I'll give you an example. Saddam Hussein. And it's just one example. What you do is you give him a certain position of power so that after you go, that's an important question. You see, they had learned a lesson from Avimelech. The lesson that they learned, that these kings had learned from Avimelech, was if you don't take care of your kids, you don't set them up as kings. What's that, go ahead?
Take care of you.
Yeah, to say the least. So what you've got is you set them up with a certain power. They're out of your way. They're distributed. They're ruling over broad areas of land. But who else you establish? And by the way, you're right. It wasn't a perfect deal, because then what you do is you wind up sending your kids all over the place. So Avdon ben Hillel probably had a better job. What did Avdon ben Hillel do? He starts to create treaties. I got kids going out. I got kids going in. I start to really... What you're seeing is an evolution of the process. It's not a perfect evolution, but you're seeing different scenarios where each one of these players tries to set them up as a king. What's interesting is the first two times are reasonably successful. I'm basing that, of course, not on their actions. I don't know anything about their actions. I'm basing it based on the years that they ruled. It looks like they ruled a nice, healthy life. They took over when they were 30, and they lived till a nice age of 55 or 60 before they killed over. Okay, I can live with that. But not these guys. These guys. In fact, if you remember, what's the famous medrash about Ibtzan? Ibtzan, of course, is supposed to be Boaz. And they tell a funny story about Boaz, because we know that Boaz doesn't have what? Doesn't have any children, right? We know that about Boaz. He's an old guy. He's got no kids. His Ruth's doing him a chesed. So how did they deal with the medrash, the fact that Ibsan is Boaz? It's very simple. Ibsan, Boaz, did not invite Manoach, the father of Shimshon, to a party. I'm not going to go into the full medrash because we'll get to it when we get to Shimshon. And because of that, all of his children died before he got to his old age. And therefore, the only child that he actually had was somebody who would eventually give Avdon, I think, or whoever would give birth to Oved, who would eventually give birth to David HaMelech. Of course, that's a difficult medrash because our Boaz here, our Ibsan here, rules only for 7 years. Difficult to say that he even had the kids during the time. Certainly there's an assassination, and what's interesting is he's having his kids before he becomes king, so you can see there's like grass for power. What's also interesting is each of these Shvatim are very specific. Each one is a separate Shevet. I got before Yiftach, I've got my first one is Yisachar. And by the way, Yisachar and the city that sets up Shomron will come very important when we get to Yerub, when we get to Kings 2. Because Yerubim the second was Shevet Ephraim. He was killed by a guy named Basha that was from none other than the tribe of Yisachar. Yisachar doesn't really rule long enough to be significant. The first significant king is Omri, the father of Achav, who sets up his capital city, Shomron, Shamir. None other than the same Shamir. So what I've got here is with Toa, I've got Yisachar. I got Yair Agiladi, which is the other side of the Menashe, the other side of Menashe. Why? Because the first side of Menashe was Gidon, and that didn't work out so well, right? Then I've got Beit Lechem, I've got Yehuda. Then I've got Zvulun. And finally, I have Piratuni. Piratuni, Chazal tell us, and we know from the place he dies, which is in Amalek in Har Ephraim, that he was actually from Shevet Ephraim. So each one of these Shvatim tries to put forward a guy with kids and kings and rulers and cities, and each one fails. But I'll show you something interesting, and now's here where we get to Yiftach. If all of these are a build-up, essentially, to Yiftach, either an epilogue or a prologue to Yiftach, how does Yiftach fill into this? Yiftach doesn't strike us as a king. He doesn't want to be king at all. He goes away, right? He doesn't want to have anything to do with his brothers. Let's take a very interesting look at the beginning section of Yiftach, and I'll show you there's more to Yiftach than meets the eye politically. And here we start with chapter 11. Actually, that's the very end of chapter 10. Let's just see who the troubles are. In chapter 11, verse 17, we have V'yitz'aku b'nei Amon v'yachanu b'gilad. So Amon gets together their armies. Remember the famous Amon? They were the brother of Moab. Vayachanu b'Gilad, and they actually camp out in Menashe's territory. Vayasvu b'nei Yisrael, vayachanu b'Mitzpah. Mitzpah, of course, is on the other side of the Jordan River. That will become important later because Mitzpah was the same place that Shmuel sets up his first battle against the Midianites. Vayomru am sarei Gilad ishorayehu. So all the people, the officers of Gilad, this would be Menashe on the other side of the Jordan River. Mi ha'ish asher yachel ilachem b'nei Amon. Who's going to help us? Who's going to help us fight? Yelarosh v'kol yosvei Gilad. Whoever will fight for us will be what?
The head of all
Gilad, i.e. the king slash shofet. But here's an interesting, funny story. We get a little bit about a personal life of Yiftach, and it's not, again, none of this is there for purely historical reasons. It's all what they would call historiographical. It's being written down, the history, it is a history, but it's being designed and the words carefully chosen to make a more important point. And we learned something about Yiftach's poor mother. Who cares? Let's read something interesting. I'll show you how smart Chazal are within Midrash. Vayiftach ha-giladi haya gibur chayo. V'hu ben isha zona. He's the son of Zona. Let's leave it untranslated for now, although the simpler translation, of course, would be a harlot. Vayolid gilad e-iftach. I am now on chapter 11, verse 1. So unless if you blink, you would miss Yiftach's father's name. What is Yiftach's father's name? Gilad. What is the tribe's name? I assure you that was a chosen name. He took upon himself the name of, because, okay, I couldn't prove it if we just had this pasuk, but from all the other psukim, from Tola, Ben Pua, and from Yair, and all these names which are chosen to indicate that I'm the head, I'm the original son, I am a representative of the original son of the leader of the tribe, the head of Gilad calls himself what?
Gilad.
Very interesting, right? Very interesting.
You saw that with Yisachar, right?
What's that? That's correct. What are you trying to say from that? Is the focus. Correct. Which means that instead of using... You're right. Normally when we focus on the Shofet, we focus on the Shofet and we mention the father's name. Here we're mentioning the father's name explicitly. You're absolutely right, and that's significant. But even the name by itself, Gilad, the head of Gilad, that's no, you know, that's no coincidence, especially after all we've seen. But Taylor Eshet Lo Banim, and the wife of Gilad gave birth to sons. Vayigalu Bnei Aisha, Vayigarshu Et Yiftach, Vayomru Lo, and they say to him, they divorce him, Lo Tinchal Beveik Avinu, you're not going to inherit in our father's house. Ki Ben Isha Acheret Ata, because you're the wife of a different one. Well, wait a second. Don't tell me that means that she's married to somebody else. It can't mean that. There's no way that we're talking about adultery here. The story would be changed completely if we were talking about an adulterous situation. What is it? Why is she Isha Zona? Zona doesn't usually mean a woman who commits adultery. Isha Zona, generally speaking, is a woman. If you go back to Vayikra, it's not talking about an adulterous woman. How do we know that? Because it says that when a Kohen will sleep with the Zona, he'll have to pay the father X amount of money. Believe me. If she was married to somebody else, and that's what Zona meant, they wouldn't be paying any money. They'd both be dying. So that's generally not speaking what Zona means. Also by Rachav HaZona. Rachav HaZona was a job. It was a job. That's what it was. It was an indication of a woman that outside of marriage, she was happy to create relationships either on a monetary basis or on a non-monetary basis.
Let's continue. Kohen was allowed?
No, it was Usher. It was Usher, but there's no death. But there's no death penalty.
I see.
And by the fact there's no death penalty, you know that Zona does not mean that she's married to somebody else.
Well, that's what I didn't understand.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to imply that it was okay. Yeah, no,
well,
just that the punishment
is right. But I was just sort of figuring out what exactly you meant there.
I'm sorry.
Is there any significance to the fact that here it doesn't tell you the number of sons? I mean, everywhere else, 30, 40, whatever. Here it's just sons.
Yeah, it's a good question. Had it said 40 kids, my whole share could have been solved 15, 20 minutes ago, and I wouldn't have to prove anything. Here I'm focusing on the name of Gilad, and I'm going to focus on something else also to prove the kingship of the father. But in Hachinami, if the number of the sons was more played out, then that would prove it was a king. But then you'll ask me, Rabbi, you can say to me, if it's true that Gilad is really the king, then why not mention the number of the sons? And I believe the answer to that question is because Gilad is not really the main player here. And since had Gilad really ever become a successful king or leader, and we'll see that he does, you know, he doesn't, then it would have mentioned his sons. But because the story isn't really about Gilad, it's about Yiftach, so we're not going to mention the quantity of the sons. I don't know if it's a great answer, but that's the best I got. Let's continue on and see
we
something
need to
interesting.
Mention the number of wives here somewhere.
Well, what this is, we seem to only have two. Right now, we seem to only have two. And by the way, don't think that's true with the other ones. The other ones, there ain't no one wife giving birth to 40 kids. It's not. It ain't happening. It's not happening. Obviously, it's multiple wives, which is also an indicator, by the way, of kids. And don't think that Gidon wasn't like that also. And taking multiple wives is also a significance of a king over, you know, it wasn't just a matter of what was Usher and what was not Usher. It was a question of what you could afford and what you couldn't afford and what, you know, how much juice you had. These things, you know, relationships were done as far as, you know, there were, what's the word, when the family of the wife would give a dowry. These things were dowry based, and they were ketubot to be written. This would be, you know, these things were arranged. You wouldn't just give a guy who already had 10 wives, you wouldn't give him an 11th wife unless you thought there was unless the father, they weren't marrying out of love. It wasn't like they were hanging out in a club and meeting each other. It wasn't happening. These were arranged by the fathers. If the fathers wanted an 11th wife to marry Gidon, it's because he felt it was significantly important. And the only way that you would think that is if you felt that he was at such a stature. And the same thing with these. I'm sorry that they don't mention the number of kids because it would driven home the point more.
Well, one of the thoughts is that, I mean, if she was really a harlot as opposed to an innkeeper, again, there may not have been a record. They may have lost track of the number, if it was not a stable relationship.
That is correct also. It's possible, though, it seems that her only son is Yiftach. It seems to be her only son is Yiftach, as far as we can sense. I'm going to continue on until just two more psukim, and then I'm going to uncover a few things in this little section. So they divorce him out. Very strange lashon, by the way. What do you mean by yigarshu? They sent him away. Strange lashon. Lashon is usually used for marriages or some kind of formal relationship, and all of a sudden we're megarshim. But let's continue to put that on the side. By yivrach yiftach mipnei achav, he actually runs away. Vayeshev be'eretz tov, he lives in a good land. Vayilak petuel yiftach anashim rekim. And he gets empty people together who go out to battle with him. You know, I want to continue on just a little bit. So So obviously they tried to fight against the Ammonites and they did not succeed. Remember, they promised whoever was able to fight would become the leader for sure of all Gilad. Everybody would accept it. So they're fighting. They're fighting. The elders of Gilad, Im Yisrael, they want to bring Yiftach back. I have a question for you. Why go to the brothers? So the only thing I could have a sense of is that he does has established. So you're right. One way of interpreting it is to say that everybody knew he was like the best leader or best military guy around, so they wanted him as a military leader. But that's not really the sense. They're not starting a battle here. Vayihimi Yamim, it's been a while. There are days gone by. Vayilachamu b'nei Yisrael, Yim Yisrael, and they're fighting with Israel. Vayihi kasher nilchamu, and while the fighting is going on, b'nei Amo Yim Yisrael, then vayilchul b'nei Yisrael. One gets the impression of how things going for the Jewish people? Not very well. And by the way, the deal has already been laid out in the previous psukim. Whoever takes over the leadership and goes out to go fight against Amoni, he'll be the leader of Israel. Where is he? He doesn't come to Yiftach. Who comes to Yiftach? The Ziknei Gilad. So my question to you is, where's Gilad? Where are the brothers? I don't know for sure, but I certainly have a sense. Anybody want to guess what's on my mind?
They're dead.
I think they're dead. I think they're dead. Otherwise, they would have gone. If they're so pushed up for it, his father is Gilad. He's a significant guy. Why does his father not go out? So you could say, because they hated him and it was embarrassing and they didn't want to talk to each other, family relationships. That's not my sense. But because the promise was already made. Hey, whoever's going to take over is going to be the leader. Well, where was the last guy? Where's the shofet of Gilad? Why are they going to Yiftach if they have a shofet? I guess he's dead. Go ahead. That's also interesting. Not conclusive, because sometimes the kids aren't mentioned only for the significant son, but you're right, very, very suspicious. So here what we have, and I can't prove any of this, but it's my sense. What we have is the people have their last, they go to the Goman. The Goman is Gilad. Gilad probably bites the dust. So they go to Gilad's sons, elder sons. They bite the dust. Why go to Yiftach? So one possibility is he's a fantastic, powerful leader. Which is possible, but the Pasuk never explicitly says that. We don't know the feats of it, but it's certainly possible. Another possibility is Gilad was the king, or at least the head leader. He's gone. Brothers are either gone or not in the ability to take the role. The only body left from the area of Gilad is Yiftach. He's the go guy. You don't have to go like that. You could say to go to Yiftach because he was the most powerful leader. It's certainly possible. But I get a sense of kingship from Gilad, and once I get a sense of kingship from Gilad, you got to figure the person that we want to go to is none other than Yiftach, although he probably was a successful leader. And here's where I want to get back to the Isha Zonah. That will highlight the problems that are going on B'nai Yisrael and why Yiftach is the bad guy that he is. Let's go back to the Isha Zonah. I'd like to read you some Farshim, and I'd like to read you this powerful Medrash. What do we need to know about his mother? First of all, the Isha Zonah, two things should remind you. Isha Zonah and the fact that he gathered together people who are Rekim, Anashim Rekim, should remind you of somebody already. And the fact that, who do they remind you of? Who was the son of an Isha Zonah, and who gathered together empty people who did terrible things? Avimelech. Go back to Avimelech. Avimelech, just like Yiftach, was the son of Isha Zonah that Gidon was foolish enough to have a relationship with. She was probably from the area of Shechem. And he also gathered together Ishim Rekim, who murdered his own brothers. We have another case of Ishim Rekim, only one other case. I don't want to go to the text now, but it's Yeravam the first, after he breaks off and he does battle with Yehuda. Yehuda writes about him. The head of Yehuda was a guy named Avi at the time, and Avi gets to the top of the mountain and said, look at you, Yeravam, you've got together a whole bunch of Anashim Rekim, which means Anashim Rekim is used previously by Abimelech, the king, by Yeravam the king. My sense here also Yiftach. But let's go to the Isha Zonah. A fascinating parish. I know you don't have it in front of you, so I'll read it to you. First, I'll take Rashi. Yishayo Zonah is in Pasuk Aleph. See, here's what Rashi says about Isha Zonah. Rashi doesn't refer to it all. Radak. Ben Pilegesh Gilad Hayah. They translate zona as a pelegish. Now, halakhically, the only difference between, halakhically, the way the rabbis said it, the difference between a pelegish and a wife is a wife has a ketubah and a pelegish doesn't. There is kiddushin by both, but a wife doesn't, what?
Mm-hmm.
It's a machloket megemara. We paskin. The halakha, again, I don't know, halakha doesn't come up that much, but when we come up the decision that if pelegish has kiddushin, she gets a certain amount of money and says, I do, so to speak, but no ketubah is written, which means she has no life / divorce insurance policy. There is another opinion in the Gemara that she has neither kiddushin nor ketubah, but she is mitiyachetin. It's not a woman who's coming and going. We're not talking about a prostitute. We're talking about somebody who simply doesn't have a kiddushin. It's an out of wedlock dedicated relationship. That's where Radak goes here. Let's listen to him. Ben pilagesh gina v'nikreit zona l'fi she'ina im ba'ala b'ketubah v'ketusha, because she doesn't have with her husband a ketubah nor kiddushin. The he kamo hazona, and that essentially makes her like a prostitute. However, afal pi shehi miyuchedet lo, even though she's dedicated, she's not a woman who's coming for the money. She is dedicated, but it's out of wedlock. But there's no kiddushin, there's no ketubah. Why the Radak takes that opinion rather than the more halakhically accepted opinion, I don't know, but he goes with that. But Yonatan Tirgame, and Yonatan Targum Yonatan, an ancient Aramaic targum, pundakita. Timosha Tirgame Gamkein Rachav Hazona, also Pundakita. Now Radak does something very strange here. Vuhu inyan ha'inyan ba'atzmo, and that's that very same issue. He has zona, because the woman who is not doesn't want to get married, who's willing not to get married, but still be with somebody, Kimoa Pundakit. She's like somebody who sells goods, Hashemafakarit at Atma, who essentially gives herself out without really getting anything for it. The normal translation, I don't know why Radak goes like that, the normal translation of Pundakit is exactly how it sounds. The word zona, not from prostitution, but from the word mazon, from food, that she is a seller of food. I don't have the pasuk off the top of my head, but there's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu which says, Vayakiz zona limkor ochel.
That's
specifically what it says.
The innkeeper.
That's correct. It actually, it's not just, it's not trying to lighten things up.
Mm-hmm.
It's an acceptable parish from,
or,
explicitly
yeah.
from Yirmiyahu, and Bli
yeah.
Nether, I'll try to remember to find the pasuk next time. It's not. It's true. When you use zona, one certainly has the impression of a certain looseness, but lo chayav lehiyot. The question, of course, by Shlomo, the two reasons on those, not necessarily that they were prostitutes at all, could be that they were just itinerant workers essentially. They sold what they could when they had it. But the Radak then goes on and to mention the whole medrash. I didn't mean that necessarily in a bad sense, but it has that kind of. But the truth is, I said it on purpose because I think that's where it gets its double meaning. A woman who sells food, an isha zona, a woman who's willing to sell herself short, so to speak, that is to be married without a ketubah. Again, I'm not talking about prostitution here, although sometimes, like with Yehuda, clearly was. But a woman who's willing to essentially dedicate herself to a man, even though she has no life / divorce insurance policy, which means no kiddushin, and she was willing to forego the acceptance of pruta that's required to do the marriage.
Living with him.
That's right. But
yeah.
A dedicated living, by
the way.
Yeah,
well, that's what.
Well, it's not too bad, you know. In modern times, it's a little free love.
But
yeah.
The choice of a word seems to be somewhat significant.
It
though,
is.
And why choose this word unless there was something behind it?
I agree completely. I agree totally. However, we'll see the word that in modern Hebrew, since zonah is taken apart only the word prostitute, we tend to lose the track of biblical Hebrew, which has multiple meanings. The first zonah we come into contact with, of course, is Yehuda and Tamar. So it certainly takes upon itself because she says, what are you going to give me for this transaction? However, most other zonot are not like that. We have, in fact, we're going to get to Pelegish Begiva.
It say
and the I think it says Eifo Akadesha, but I think it uses the word, hold on. Lamed Gimel, I believe. Hold on a second. It would be Pasuk Perek Lamed Zion, I think, or Lamed Chet. Vayirei Yehuda vayachshaveh lezona ki chisitafaneh. So it does use the word zona in that particular case. However, in many other places I mentioned Vayikra uses the word zona just as somebody who sleeps with somebody without marriage. The word zona by Shlomo is certainly inconclusive. We're going to have Pelegish Begivanah that says that there was this Levi who had a Pelegish about his name Me'ba'alav, she was zonah from her husband, and you can't say that she committed adultery, because believe me, he wouldn't be run. The scenario would be completely different. Likely, she simply just went back to her father's house. You could say it was adultery, but it's a difficult thing to say. So the word zona, while it does indicate a looseness and a willing to sell, it does not necessarily mean prostitution, and therefore I think we need to understand it has a negative connotation, but not necessarily the negative connotation.
No, but where I was going really was, why use this word or a word at all describing
we'll see.
The mother? I mean,
we'll
there,
see.
There seems to be a reason it's there.
Yeah, we'll
it's
see.
Not necessary.
We'll see. We'll see. Exactly right. And it combines with the other description of her, which is Vayehi ben Isha Acheret. Now here, how are you going to translate Acheret? Are you going to say that she was married to somebody else? It's almost impossible to believe such a thing. So how do I take the word Zona, how do I take the word Acheret, and match them together and get a picture of who this woman is? So Chazal says something tremendous. Now you can understand this Medrash's pshat if you wish, although I'm not sure I would. But to miss their point is to miss the whole parsha altogether. So let's read the Medrash. I'm not going to read it inside because it's a little bit too long. I'm going to read the Radak brings it down quote by, full quote. The Ralbag sums it up, and this is what he says: Ben Isha Zona, Upirshu Bo, which means the Radak has given the parish, Shekvar Haya Ben Isha. Shaita Mishevet Acher. She was not a prostitute. She was not a. She may have even been married. Or, no, I'm sorry, she wasn't married to. Before we get to the issue of marriage status, we're not talking about somebody who, where there's something bad about them. What the only thing bad about her was that she was from a different tribe. So you say, so what? She was from a different tribe? Listen to this. That's what Chazal says. Ulefi Shalom Nisat Lechad Bibnei Ashevet. And because she refused to get married from one of her own tribesmen, Kara Zona, she was called a wanton woman. Lihiyota notemi masha ra'ui lihi nasei, because she turned away from that which she was supposed to marry, le'echad mi mishpachta, to somebody from her own family. Kedosha lo tasov nachala mi matei lematei. Remember the story of the Tzlafcha daughters. And the issue is that there are no sons, the daughters get the property. Bah! After Tzlafchad got the ruling that they were allowed, Tzlafchad's daughters ruled that they were allowed to get the territory, Menashe shows up, none other than Menashe, by the way, and says, not fair. Not fair. If they marry to some other tribe, we'll lose our land. So Moshe says, okay, we'll fix it. If they marry some other tribe, then it goes back to tribal lands. I believe that's how it works. We'd have to take a look at the end of Bamidbar. Although we believe that was, according to Chazal, that was only a Horat Shah. It doesn't work that way permanently. That was a Horat Shah for one time in order to appease the Menashites. For that one time, give them back the land. But the general rule is that the women are the only inheritors. The daughters, they get the land. Whoever they marry, they marry. What's going on here, though? Connect all the dots together. A woman is called a Zonah if she's chutzpahdik enough to weaken the status of the tribe that she's in. Do you see what's going on politically in Israel? Israel, instead of being a unified country with very nice tribal customs, has divided this point into complete and total tribalism. Haraya, what's the proof? Yitzhak will wind up murdering in civil war, I think 40,000 of his brother tribe, of Yosef. Whereas Gidon went out of his way to make peace among Bnei Yisrael, Yitzhak will kill other people in Bnei Yisrael. What will lead a person to kill other Peshvatim Bnei Yisrael? What will lead a Huti to kill a Tuti? If you don't feel any connection or brotherly love whatsoever. So see what Chazal have done? They've created a situation where there's been an onus on this woman that by leaving her tribe, she's created a sin equal to being a Zonah. And by the fact that Yiftach married her, Gilad married her, oy vavoy on Gilad, it creates such a stigma that the son who comes out of it is a reckless and a boy who's willing to take on Rikhanim.
On the other hand, if Gilad is looking to try to establish himself as a ruler, it would not be surprising he would marry someone from a different group or a different entity.
I agree, and it fails completely. Bnei Yisrael not willing to accept it. They're too divided in their little delicious. And by the way, that explains why before Yiftach's story, Yair Giladi only sent his sons to the cities of Chavot Yair, which is only in his tribe. But when we get to Ibtan, what does Ibtan do with his daughters and his sons? Sends them achutza, brings him in. You see, we have a progression. There's this attempt. Oh, well, the last guy didn't do so well. Gidon didn't do so well on the king thing. I get that impression. In fact, he's got 70 dead kids. What I'll do is I'll take my kids, I'll set them up in different places, and I'll get them status, etc., etc. That doesn't work out so well. So Yiftach tries to do a little cross-tribal Yiftach's father, falls apart completely. The Israel is so factionated that it doesn't work. So instead of sending out, apologize, it's not a medrash, it's a shot. So Yiftach tries to do it again, apparently by sending 30 out and 30 in, maybe he establishes something more acceptable, although ultimately that would be doomed to failure also, because he only made it 7 years and he was apparently killed or died in battle. But what you see here is Yiftach is not an isolated incident. Yiftach is a progression of Bnei Israel has had the taste of a king. And they've seen how close they got and then the total abject failure. Because that's really what Sefer Shoftim is about, and I'll end in the next few minutes, so right on time. Sefer Shoftim is about trying to establish a king. How do I know that? Because then the Sefer Shoftim says three times over, Vayin Melech Yisrael Isha Yashar Be'enav Yaseh. Shmuel doesn't like the idea that there's anarchy, but he also doesn't like the idea of the people setting up the king in every which way they want. In fact, that'll explain to you. Remember when the Jews come to Shmuel and they say, we want a king like all the other kings, and everybody is upset about it. Of course he's upset about it. Not because it's the first time he has a sense that something's wrong. Shmuel knows that there's something sick and evil about setting up a king for all the wrong reasons. Not to be a leader of the entirety of the Jewish people under the auspices of God, but to be willing to satisfy your own economic needs, your own political needs. Yiftach runs away from all that. He wants to have nothing from it. In fact, at the very end, he'll say, why are you bothering me with my Am? When he's killing all the other Ephraim guys, he says, why did you come over here to my Am? Referring to all of Shevet Gidon as an Am, as a complete Am, totally separate and distinct from the Jewish people. So Yiftach, who said the Medrash earlier today? Yiftach Bedoro. Yeah. Yiftach Bedoro, a famous Medrash. Yiftach Bedoro, that is, Yiftach was, that is, that... Shmuel Bedoro, I don't remember exactly who the other one was, who was good versus bad, but it's what Chazal was trying to tell you is much more than just saying this was the level of the people. Yiftach was a natural emanation of the people who were around him. He wasn't an anomaly. He was a normal building step into the status of political sickness that had enveloped the Jewish people at the time. First, up until Gidon's time, because they refused to establish a king to unify the people, and then afterwards, because they're trying to establish a king in all the wrong ways, without the auspices of God, and with nothing to really talk about. And it comes to its head, really, in Yiftach. The truth is, where does it really come to its head? It comes to the head to its Shimshon. Who did Shimshon lead? Nobody. Shimshon was a leader of nobody. He was a single guy out to knock off a bunch of Plishtim, which is really where it ends. The last guy that we'll get to is a guy that refused to accept any responsibility whatsoever. He doesn't want to be the leader of anybody and never does become the leader of anybody. And that's where it all leads to, because of all these failed kings, finally Shimshon doesn't even try. There's not even an attempt made. And rejects him. That's right. We don't want anything to do with you. Exactly right. And but he doesn't run away because he wants them to follow them. He knows they're not going to follow him. He just, do me a favor, one thing. Just don't kill me. I'll take care of myself. He doesn't even try to set up a relationship with them. Absolutely right. So that's essentially where Yiftach comes from. And what we didn't get to today, we'll get to Mirtz Hashem next Wednesday, is the whole fight that Yiftach, now that we've established Yiftach and who he was, we're going to talk about who his enemy is, Amon, and we're going to see this whole political reality which is on these maps of what the old fight is between Amon and Bnei Israel. It's very interesting stuff. And what is it with the god called Chemosh versus the god of Israel? Is he a frum guy for saying whatever your god gives you is yours, whatever our god gives us is ours? Is he a frum guy? Is he not a frum guy? And we'll get to the entire battle, which is very interesting. So we'll do that in Mirtz Hashem next week. Have a good night. Thank you.